In terms of the overall economy, I think that the pressure and stress has increased since we spoke in January. In terms of financial markets, I think that there's a lot of madness still dominant. So whether we have to wait a few more months for some of this federal money to dissipate out of the U.S. economy and then the impacts that's sort of driving things in terms of holding up some demand. But I think that we're getting to the very end of how long that can continue. And then we've got these interest rates, as I say, still, you know, normal by long term. I'm not saying they're extreme historically, they're normal, but the debt service costs are extreme. And so I don't think we've fixed anything. I think that we're going to continue to see downward pressure on the risk side. We need to. That's a good thing, but it's going to be painful for those people that are holding that.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. When today's guest appeared for the first time on this channel a few months ago, a star was born. Those who hadn't yet heard of Danielle Park were impressed by both her command of the macro data and her unflinching courage to call things as she sees them. She highlighted a number of concerns about the trajectory of the economy and the markets back then, and today we check back in with her to see whether things have improved or gotten worse. Danielle, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you, Adam. Quite the intro.
Well, well deserved. So people have been asking me ever since your first appearance here, hey, when is Danielle Park going to come back on the program? Happy to scratch that itch for them today and have you back on. I know you've been very busy in the interim, writing all your analysis, traveling the world. Last time I talked to you, I think you were based over in Europe for a while. So anyways, thanks so much for coming back. Now you're talking to us from Canada, which is where you're located. Canada, as I think we've talked about before, I think in many ways is giving the US a preview of coming attractions, but we'll talk about that in more detail in just a moment. If we can, let's kick this off with a general question I like to start with. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Oh boy, I wish I could have said that we've made a lot of good progress since we last spoke in January. I was hoping that would be the case, but I would say that in many ways we've kind of gone back in terms of, like, when I say progress, I mean movement towards rational metrics and investment opportunity. And what I would say that in the past 4 months, we've kind of gone backwards again in the sense of mania is back, speculation is back, crazy behavior everywhere you look. And asset valuations really haven't made any progress to the downside. Even though they haven't really gone anywhere for a couple of years, we're pretty much back to the type of peak valuations we saw at the top in the 2022, so 2 years ago. And that's kind of disappointing. The good news, I guess, is that we're getting closer to the rate cutting portion of this cycle. And when we look at the restoration of value, it typically starts to manifest more during the cutting cycle. Unfortunately, that's also when unemployment starts to pick up, and we're starting to see that now. So I think in terms of the overall economy, I think that the pressure and stress has increased since we spoke in January. In terms of financial markets, I think that there's a lot of madness still dominant.
Okay. Yes, and on the day that you and I are talking, GameStop continues its incredible increase here. So I think it's gone from, at least this morning, 2 days ago it was trading at $17, which it had been trading at for a long time. More than doubled yesterday, and then today I think it's up to something like $56 a share, right? So.
Right.
We're kind of back to the meme stock craziness. Yeah.
Well, exactly. And even after people saw the movie Dumb Money, which was really well done. But I guess people are still interested in being dumb. And there's many factors behind that. Probably desperation is one of them. As I said, there's an increasing strife in the overall economy and the household sector for sure. But we're seeing that in, you know, 50% of all the options being traded are zero dated options. They expire the same day, you know, huge speculative tool there. The double levered ETFs, again, have taken in the biggest flows since they did at the top of the craziness in 2022. So everything, the gambling urge is alive and well.
The gambling urge is alive and well. Another way to say that speculation is still quite rife in today's markets. All right, so I've got a lot of questions for you based in large part on your recent work, Danielle. I'm going to pull out a few quotes if I can, because you made the comment that you think we're closer to the cutting part of the central bank cycle with interest rates. And you talk about that a lot, actually, in one of your recent reports. You say, inflation is always a concern at expansion tops. And actually today, we just had the producer price index come out here in the States, and it was a lot hotter than folks expected. So people are still very concerned about higher for longer inflation right now, and perhaps, you know, it's going in the wrong direction, meaning that Powell is going to be stuck more likely in not being able to bring rates down as soon as the market would hope. You say, okay, inflation's always a concern at expansion tops. We've got that concern right now. But once some central banks start easing interest rates, others tend to follow as economic downturns prove contagious and disinflation takes over. So I'd just like to have you expound on that, if you will, given where you think we are in that cycle.
Sure. So we know that the Swiss and Sweden central banks already cut their policy rate in the past couple of months. Developing economy or emerging economy central banks have already started cutting rates. And this is really in response to the downturn they're seeing in demand, in consumption, in households and businesses, CapEx, all of it is really in decline in most countries at this point. The UK data that was out today, you know, unemployment is on the rise all over and consumption is in decline. So that is the sort of top line of companies, the revenue sales number. And as I say, they can work with the net income. They can do buybacks to boost their earnings per share, but it's very hard to fix the revenue or sales side once it starts to fall. And the same applies for governments, of course, because the revenue that flows from the, you know, transactions activities in the real economy flows into the coffers of governments and vice versa when they start to see the slowing. So that's definitely happening. Tax receipts are down across the board, and again, reflecting that. So I think that, you know, the U.S. has no doubt been the standout here. You know, the top 10 most expensive companies in the world trade on the U.S. markets. When you look at earnings per share, they have been attributing the entire increase pretty much in earnings has come from those top 10 companies, whereas the bulk of the other, you know, 490 companies or so have been losing money in the last over the last year in their earnings. So it's really a bifurcated story, but it's also in terms of markets, right? So again, the U.S. has had all the, you know, the fiscal support for the investment in the new economy and the transition to the new energy systems and the grid and all that stuff, which I see as quite positive in the longer run. But other countries are struggling because they don't have the, you know, U.S. dollar as their base currency. They don't have the ability to sell debt as much as the U.S. does. So you have a way to generate income or to raise money to do these investments that other countries simply don't have. Mm-hmm. And so they're really feeling the slump because they don't have the fiscal inputs that you're seeing in America. So again, there's that bifurcation, not just in between the companies, not just between Wall Street and Main Street, which we're seeing in spades, but also all across the world in terms of the US and most other countries.
All right, Danielle, in a moment, I hope to be able to ask you, you know, even if tougher times may lie ahead for everybody, might the U.S. end up pulling further away from the rest of the herd, given those relative advantages you just mentioned? But I want to stay on interest rates for just a minute here. I'm going to start reading another post that you wrote here. While some hope rate cuts will save the day and prevent financial pain from spreading, in truth, rate cuts traditionally signal the onset of the most punishing part of bear markets and job loss cycles. And I'm going to just pull up this chart here from the Federal Reserve's economic data. This just shows the federal funds effective rate. And you can see here, all these recessions, the shaded areas that we have in the chart, are all pretty much preceded by an aggressive ramp up in the federal funds rate, some sort of plateau. And then as we enter recession, the Fed is cutting rates, right? And we're generally cutting rates all through the arrival of the recession and the trough of the recession. And that just seems to be repeated again and again and again and again and again and again. And here we are, we have that exact same curve right now that we've seen many times in the past. Who knows? We may actually be in recession right now, but won't find out until the authorities report it, long after the fact. But, sort of what you're saying there is what history has shown is the pattern here. So do you expect history to repeat here? And B, I'll let you again expound more on the warning of, markets really looking forward to rate cuts because it thinks that's going to mean happier, even happier times are ahead, even though it's amped up on speculation right now. But I think you're saying is no. Once the rate cut regime starts arriving, that's when all the wheels come off and you get the bad economic growth and the big market corrections.
Yes, because it's the second wave, right? So the first wave is they cut rates too low and leave them there too long. And we've seen that in spades the past few cycles, like to extremes that no one would have ever imagined possible 40 years ago, 30 years ago. It was never in my CFA material anywhere that they were going to take the base rate in the banking system to zero and leave it there for years. But in
Yeah.
fact,
And
that's what
sorry,
happened.
let me just highlight for folks here on this chart, pretty much from December of 2008 to February of 2022, that's what? That's like 13 and a half years. It
Yeah.
was pretty much at zero, except for just a couple of years where it got up into the ones, right? Maybe hit two briefly, but I mean, for the better part of a decade and a half, we had basically, historically, aberrantly record low interest rates.
Sure. And the thing is that the net effect of that was record high debt creation, right? So this is why it ends up being a balloon that slows us in the end, because people get so complacent with the amount of debt they take on. I was telling people during the era of low rates, for the love of God, please pay off your debt. Use low rates to get out of debt. But unfortunately, the masses didn't do that. They used it to pile on debt. So did companies, right? Companies have record amounts of even the junkiest companies borrowed the most money. So that was the trend. And that's why once they go to normalize, quote unquote, interest rates, move them back up, that there's a lag, as you know, but then it always comes home to roost in the form of a great sharp downturn in the ability to consume and spend, because now people have this balloon of the high debt and the normalized interest rates. And so that's why it takes some time to filter through. But once it does, the central banks respond with, oh boy, now we have to rush to the rescue again. With help like this, they're going to kill us. But this is basically it. So they rush to the rescue in response to increasing unemployment, which, as I say, we're already starting to see in most of the world economies, and in the US in many ways, the labor market has been deteriorating as well. Although, as you know, revised lower after the fact, a lot of revisions come in later. But that's already happening. And so when you've got record debt levels, record debt payments as a percentage of disposable income, and then you see an erosion in household income, that's when you really get that next leg down. And that's where they sort of respond with, at first it's, oh, don't worry, we got this, right? We're going to cut, don't worry. And then it's, oh my God, we were going to cut a lot more. And then it always goes the other way, where there's a panic, if you will, to try and re-stimulate. And that takes some time to work through as well. So there's always that, that lag of several months to quarters before you really start to see it and its impact.
All right. So, regular viewers of this channel know that I beat the lag effect drum probably more than they would like me to. But it sounds like you are on team lag effect as well, saying that,
Well,
look,
and you
go
know
ahead.
what, Adam? I was thinking about this, and I think that we've all been so conditioned this in the last few years, more than ever in history, to be so short-term focused. We have the attention span of a gnat, right? Everybody wants like instant facts, and they love people who, tell them everything's going to be great. For the most part, that's the optimistic message people love to hear, because there's a lot of fear about the future. The future is inherently uncertain, right? What did Galbraith say? There are two kinds of forecasters, those who don't know and those who know they don't know. So the thing is, though, because of that, you can only really pay attention to these macro trends that have been tried and true, and behaviors that have been obvious and replicated throughout time. And, you know, try and move ahead of the pack, try and move in the opposite of the masses. That's where your best chance of surviving and thriving through full cycles come from. But unfortunately, most people, as I say, they're responding to the latest, you know, headline or click or 5 second bit, and they don't have the macro perspective. So that's where they really get into the wrong positioning and into destructive behaviors.
So I'm glad you took it here. So let me just ask you this question. You know, in many ways, you can argue that the great irony of how now that we live in an era where everybody has the world's knowledge available to them in their pockets, we've never been dumber, right? Mm. You know, we spend our time watching TikTok videos, and, you know, our test scores are down, our education systems are regressing. I mean, it's just, there is a great irony of that, right? We've made all the world's information freely available to everybody, and yet we've kind of never been so collectively dumb. We all also have more market data available to us at our fingertips than we ever had before in history. And yet we seem so short-termism, like you said. You know, we have this incredibly short-term attention span, and we seem to have totally forgotten the lessons of history, and even relatively recent history, even though we have more data than ever. It just seems like a great contradiction. But I, you know, this is why I love the field of behavioral economics, because there's so yeah. much about how humans deal with numbers and money and risk that is so, as Dan Ariely says, predictably irrational.
Yeah, and critical thought is a lot of work. You know, you think about the energy that needs to be expended in order to be critical and to read and to comprehend, you know, and to explain it to other people. Like, a lot of people just take in junk, put out junk, and don't have any real awareness or understanding. They're not really enriched by the exercise of it. And of course, we all have certain areas where we have a bit of a leg up, or practical information or experience or actual education in a field. But I think it's just, there's so much now that people are really overwhelmed, and you can get the impression of knowing, you know, sometimes a little is the worst thing, because you get one person's take on something and you take that as the gospel, and sometimes it can be really misleading. And I think, you know, we don't, as mostly the human species doesn't like change, I think, is the mm-hmm. is the nub of it. I think I see that in, you know, my colleagues and my friends and my community and people I respect in many ways, that have, you know, intelligence or education or good insight in certain aspects, and yet they miss completely the big macro changes that are going on around us. And indeed, it's one thing to say, you know, you miss the change and you don't know anything about it, but people tend to take positions like it's not going to change, or it's not happening, or denying what's actually going on in real time in favor of their status quo. And I think that can be really dangerous.
Oh, well, all right. So we're working against our better nature here. And I've again, regular viewers will have listened to Lance Roberts and I on the weekends, you know, warn people about trading based upon headlines, because so much of what gets pumped out today is truly more entertainment than it is education. And things are nuanced in the investing world. And we also, because of the way that social digital media works, we will curate our own little echo chambers most often, but also the internet knows what we like to read and will serve us more of it. So we tend to just see a lot of data that reaffirms what we're already thinking, whether it's true or not, right?
You're
not
and the whole system is driven by salesmanship, right? So the whole financial system is product creators who are trying to get your cash in exchange for a product. So all of the financialtainment pretty much is sponsored by that particular view. Most of the people who talk or, you know, analysts work for the sell side primarily. So there's really, or even people that are on the buy side, if they have a particular kind of strategy or product, they're basically always talking their book. And so that means they want people to give them cash in this strategy, whether that strategy is in favor, out of favor, a good probability of success in the, you know, the next year or not. And it is very much a cycle. So no one's going to be in favor all the time. So you couple that with the reality that people today have very short attention spans and little, it seems, stomach for sticking. Grit seems to be out of favor, right? So if something's not working in a very short time horizon, they tend to want to jump out of moving vehicles, change tact, you know, go to the person who's telling them the new great thing. And mm-hmm. so this can all be very dangerous. It's, you know, it's why I'm very critical of even the regulatory environment around the financial services sector, because it tends to be bought and paid for by the status quo sell side. Mm-hmm. And people are just getting terrible information and advice. And, you know, the thing about gambling is, as I've said this before, but it's just so key. Gambling is gambling, right? If you're going to the casino, you know you're gambling. If you're at the horse races, you know you're gambling. So you would put a certain portion of your money after that, you know, and say, well, I can afford to lose that. I'm not expecting to win, but it's just for fun. The problem is that people are doing that in financial markets with the bulk of their savings, and they don't realize that the odds are almost as bad in terms of the long-term outcome because they think they're investing. And to be investing, you have to do something that's, as I say, typically contra to the masses, extremely patient, extremely value-focused, disciplined, all these things that people tend to be terrible at and that the sell side really doesn't want them to focus on anyway.
That is a great way to enumerate it. So, you know, I hope with the platform of this channel here at Thoughtful Money, we're trying to help people actually leverage the expertise of the seasoned investors who know how to do it the way that you're talking about and are being reminded of these long-term best practices and thoughtful approaches. And hopefully that provides some shield to the screaming headlines and what's going on. But it is interesting, just one more thing to add to this, and then I'll get back to my questions here, is you know, one of the things that I really regret is that for younger generations of investors, and I really think, I mean, millennials and below, like if you're a millennial, you've largely been taught call speculating investing.
Yeah.
And a huge part of that is, you know, it's the millennials and the Gen Zs who understandably have said, look, I'm looking ahead and I don't know how I'm going to be able to afford the lifestyle my parents had. Right. In fact, probably the only way I'm going to be able to make it is if I get a rocket ride. Right. If I jump into a meme stock that shoots the moon, or I buy the right crypto or whatever. Right. And so much of their investment history to date has been in these highly, highly speculative asset classes. And that's really all they know. And they haven't been taught nor shown really that, no, you know, these much more time-honored approaches to, you know, active investing and building a diversified portfolio and doing position sizing and picking a thesis and staying with it even if the it's going against you initially, but your underlying argument is still there and you're waiting for the right cycle. They just haven't developed that those muscles, right? Yeah. So they're kind of
Like getting debt free before you even try and do that kind of stuff is a huge piece of long-term success. And yet, you know, and I must say, Americans shock me all the time because you guys have really bought the whole idea that debt is good, it seems, hook, line, and sinker. Because I just can't believe it. Like, you know, that latest Meredith Whitney article that came out and talked about how she thinks this is great that the
Freddie Mac
is going to start buying up second mortgages and securitize those. So people will be able to take out, you know, unleash equity up to 80% of their home value. It's like, this is not good. This is not going the right way. And she's saying, you know, this could never be better for Wall Street, for the household, for the economy. It's like, well, sure, it would unleash a short-term way for people with no money to spend whatever equity they have in their house. So sure, it'll probably boost consumer spending for a short period of time. But at what cost? At the cost of long-term stability and strength, and them, you know, literally cannibalizing whatever savings they've been able to amass in their home up until that point. So that whole mindset that what we have to do is figure out how to get people to borrow more and spend more on credit has really been the bane of our existence for the past, you know, many years. And I blame that to a large degree on this really low interest rate policy, this intervention, this incessant pushing by central banks to try and get us to spend our brains out. And it's worked. But now we have the overhang of that, right? And so trying to extend and pretend that further, in my view, is going the opposite direction of how we should be. And I realize that spending less in the short term is a short-term negative for a consumption-driven economy, but it is how you build wealth and strength for the longer term in the economy.
So sing it, sister, hallelujah. I completely agree with you. Just to explain why we Americans are so, you know, hyper-leveraged the way that we are, it's like you said with the sell side of Wall Street, which is, you know, this is a result of over-financialization where the system makes its money by people borrowing from them and then owing all the fees and the interest or whatever. So we get marketed to it all the time. The first thing a college student gets when they arrive on their campus for the first time, because they've just turned 18, they open their college mailbox on day one, and it's just stuffed with credit card offers. And of course, they just probably took on a bunch of debt to attend college anyways. They are basically marketed that it is the right and responsible thing to do. And of course, for all the reasons that you can enumerate, and I will agree with you, it's exactly the wrong thing to do in most cases for wealth building. But Wall Street doesn't care. And I think we've gotten to the point where our political system is so captured by these moneyed interests that, you know, they feed their profits right back into legislation that's going to help them continue to do this. And I don't think that we're going to wake up one day proactively and say, you know what, this is getting a little out of hand. Let's dial it back. We're going to have some sort of major crisis. And only then will the door hopefully open for reform.
Hopefully, yes. And I mean, the good news is, again, I think we're getting to the point where it's starting to become a pretty big issue. Debt service costs are really through the roof, and the Fed is still concerned about inflation. And if they do anything like that Freddie Mac, you know, securitization of home equity loans, that's going to boost inflation further. So I think it's, you know, and at current rates, right? So if the Fed is frozen and isn't going to move because they can't lower rates justifiably in a high inflation environment, then, you know, we're not, as I say, home equity lines of credit are still at prevailing rates, right? So it's not like they're going to be magically at 2% or something, right, in terms of cost. So I think the good news is, as I say, it's a cycle, because there's a lot of madness that goes on. There's a lot of adding on. And then at some point you get to the breaking point where income no longer supports more payments. And then you get this downturn, and we're seeing it. Look at Home Depot today said, you know, the home improvement train has left the building. No one seems to be fixing up their place anymore. You know, you see it across the board in all the restaurant data, in the McDonald's and, you know, Starbucks and all that. They're saying, wow, people are really pulling back, and they're doing that of necessity. But in that will hopefully become, you know, some healing, even if it's forced.
Right. And it's interesting that we're hearing it now in these earnings calls from these consumer, you know, facing brands. We haven't seen retail sales like really crack yet, but I'm assuming that that's a shoe that'll be dropping relatively soon. All right. So, you know, there's a lot of sign of cracks in the system. But of course, if you look at the headline data right now, for the most part, you know, it still looks like things are holding together. And at least that's what our authorities are telling us. That's what Jerome Powell, you know, talks about. He just said, what, a week and a half ago, I don't see the stag. I don't see the inflation. Everything looks pretty good to me. So, you know, I understand why people kind of challenge the lag effect because this has managed to kind of be held together longer than I think many of us analysts had expected it to. And maybe part of that is because it's an election year and there may be a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes just to try to keep everything together until November. But it's clear, Danielle, that you see that this is not sustainable. Of course, the longer we're at higher for longer, that Powell can't bring rates down, the weight of those higher interest rates for a longer period of time than expected will just amplify the lag effect even further when it arrives. So when this thing starts to tip, if I can just ask you a couple questions about this, like how when how what severity level are you expecting this next downturn to be? Will it be slower growth and disinflation? Will it be recession and eventual deflation? Like how bad could this get?
So I think recession is the probable outcome. No one knows, of course, the severity or length of said recessions. They are very hard to estimate in advance. But if you look at the change in the rate of unemployment, you know, whether you're looking at whatever rule you saw or McKelvey or any of these rules, they're suggesting that we probably are already in a recession. And you know, again, the data is not very helpful. As you know, Adam, for example, the last big recession in 2000 started in December of 2007, and it wasn't until the summer of 08 that we started to get any indication of that in the backward-looking GDP data. And they went on to revise that all the way to 2018. So it got increasingly more negative in retrospect, the GDP data, but that by then you're out of the recession. So all of that is not very helpful. So the things that really matter are, can people go into it with some cash, not have all their life savings in the casino, which most people do? They either have next to no life savings in terms of liquid cash. Any savings they have tends to be in the casino, and they tend to go into these downturns with high debt levels. And that's why they fare so badly. So I think I sent you a chart I like to show that Gary Shilling published in one of his letters. And it is about the dividend theme, right? So this is something you're going to hear a lot of people talk about right now is, you know, again, with always having to come up with what to buy ideas, they will say, well, you know, for the equity space, what we like is dividend paying. You know, you want to come in the risk spectrum, you want to be in quality, you want to be in the value somewhere where they're paying you an income while you wait, et cetera. All fine, except it is a relative trade, and people don't understand this very often. So, relatively speaking, dividend-paying stocks, mature companies with, you know, strong balance sheets, typically fare better than the meme stocks, right? Or the high yield credit, or the junk debt, or the companies that have, you know, no way to pay the bills unless they can keep borrowing money. So those companies tend to have a catastrophic effect in the downturn part of the cycle. And we're starting to see that now where they're making negative earnings and they're going bankrupt. You know, Canadian bankruptcies are up 87% year over year. And the US, it's, I think it's 43% up year over year at this point. So we're starting to see that. Access to public market, the public corporations that are still able to borrow, they've had a bit of a boon in the last little while because financial conditions loosened while the stock market and the credit market rallied since last fall. So they've been able to refinance. You know, companies see their share price go up and they're like, great, let's sell, you know, more shares to people while they have an aptitude or an appetite to buy it. And we'll take more cash out of the market, so to speak. So that's all happening. And I think that the next part of this is that the dividend paying stuff also tends to go down significantly when you get into the rate cut part of the cycle, when they're responding to the downturn, when they're responding to recessionary impacts, when the jobless rate starts to climb. And that's because, you know, they are equities just like all the rest. They are places where people have put cash. Typically, they come in, as I say, unprepared with insufficient liquidity. And when everyone's looking for liquidity, they start trying to sell whatever they can. And they will ask for redemptions from mutual funds who then turn around and have to sell these things they intended to have as quote unquote long-term holdings. And you get this spiral effect. So it's not true that dividend stocks are going to be this great panacea or protection or from any sort of bear market outcome. And they also tend to go down. So I have to bring this up because, again, as an anecdote to what people are getting 24 hours a day now, you know, with the way the internet is available for information on financial markets, people are inundated with, well, you know, we think that it's a long-term hold and you're better off to stay and all that. That's all fine and well, but it's just like with real estate, people don't stay indefinitely in an asset for a whole bunch of reasons, right? And most of them are life things that happen, like divorce or death or or loss of job or, you know, decline in some other part of their portfolio where they have to raise cash. All these things cause people to need to sell things. And I think the worst thing they do is they go in, as I say, with too little cash and a lot of these risk assets, which they've been told to buy, which also start to plunge. And then they typically bail at the bottom and have a lot of lasting harm from it.
All right. So you're putting your finger on, you know, what I try to put my finger on with almost every one of these videos, which is, look, Wall Street, they're going to do fine no matter what happens here, because they're taking their pound of flesh from all the capital that they're convincing to get into whatever they're convincing it to get into. And no matter what happens, they're probably highly likely to get some sort of bailout at the end of the day here. But what happens is the regular investor, you know, especially the less educated regular investor, is just doing what they're being told by the machine. And they basically, you know, slam into the recession, you know, driving 100 miles per hour, right? They just, it catches them totally by surprise. And they are generally positioned absolutely the opposite of how you would want to be at the time that this all happens. So when you were talking about the dividend stocks, Danielle, I just want to let you know, I did show the chart that you had sent over, and you're true. I mean, most of those sectors, their averages across the last several recessions were down 30%, down 40%, whatever. So it's not a great shield. So we'll get in a few minutes to, given your outlook, you know, what sort of asset allocation makes sense to you. But before we get there, you mentioned a few things. So you mentioned housing, and then, you know, you mentioned job loss is one of the reasons why sometimes people just have to sell their house no matter what's going on. What is your expectation for the jobs market right now? Let's start there. Do you expect this to be sort of like what we saw back in 2028, where we were having hundreds of thousands of jobs a month basically get lost in the worst of it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of factors here. There's a short-term factor, which is the unemployment rate has already begun to rise. And once it does start and they get into the cutting part of the cycle, it's typical to see the unemployment rate rise a couple of percent all the way through into the next recovery. So even after the economy has bottomed in terms of GDP, it's typical to see companies continue to cut their overhead to try and raise cash, because again, they come into these cycles ill-prepared as well. So it is typical to see the unemployment rate continue to rise. And I think that that's going to happen over the next year at least. The other factor, Adam, that is very rarely touched on is this whole robotic evolution, right? What people generally don't understand is the reason that the autonomous driving software has been such a focus of companies like Tesla and many others who are now racing to catch up is that it's not just to be used with automobiles. It's the same technology that they are developing for use with humanoid robots. So this, I know, sounds very, you know, space age and crazy, and I find very few analysts even are aware of this trend. But the fact is that we have this AI and we have the rise of autonomous software and ability to have things automated at a time when we have an aging workforce and companies looking at how to cut overhead. And there is no question that the pace, if you look at the work from some think tanks like Rethinks, they're talking about this escalation in the ability to supplant humans with these robotic replicas or interventions, and that's going to greatly lower the cost of labor, which is disinflationary. So awesome in terms of finally, you know, increasing output, productivity, all that is greatly enabled. Now there's a question about how people are going to be getting income. Mm-hmm. But in the medium term, I think that is a force that is going to displace workers as well. So I think that there's, the cyclical, recessionary, downturn in credit, consumption-driven economy, and housing downturn, which, by the way, is always the worst. Recessions tend to be led by housing, and we've got that happening in Canada already, and other countries for sure. And I think in the U.S., you're just a bit behind, but you are also in the midst of a downturn in housing. I mean, you've got the worst home sales in 30 years, the worst mortgage applications in 30 years. I mean, it's hitting for sure. So I think there's a lot of factors here that people should think about in terms of their ability to earn income and cash and pay their bills. And that is a long-term trend, not just a cyclical one, but with respect to this robotic evolution.
Yeah, let me ask you a question about that. So, what I hear you saying is look, we may shed a lot of jobs in this recession, but they may not come back the way that they have from previous ones, and that lack of jobs coming back might be a secular trend across the rest of our lives here. I've written about this for really over a decade, about the massive incentive, some might call it a malincentive, that we have given corporate America to try to accelerate its efforts to find replacements to human labor, because the cost of human labor has been skyrocketing for a whole bunch of reasons, even before things got real nutty with the pandemic. Technology improvements tend to happen exponentially, tend to move at an exponential rate. Anyways, the question I want to ask you is there is an old concept in economics called technological displacement, which basically says if you can replace human labor with technology because the technology does the job more efficiently, you should. But you have to be careful at the rate in which you displace the labor. If you displace the labor, human labor, faster than you can repurpose to other productive use, you end up creating a social crisis, the cost of which may oftentimes be larger than the gains of the technology improvement, right? And I do think that that's a big question mark right now, which is,
Absolutely.
we could really displace a lot of human labor. I mean, AI is already, coming on strong, and robotics. That still kind of feels a little bit out there in the Jetson world, but I mean, Amazon's got a crap ton of robots that are doing what used to be done by humans, in its warehouses. And you see the Boston Scientific and other robotics companies. I mean, those things, the rate of evolution of those humanoid robotics is pretty staggering.
Yep.
So, how concerned are you that we may create a pretty big social crisis here of underemployed or unemployed people that really can't find a job, and we may have to turn to some sort of national welfare, UBI, whatever, just to kind of help people put food on the table. But even if we're keeping people fed, keeping people stuck in the sort of purposeless environment where they're just subsisting, it's not good for a society, in my opinion.
Yeah, we have a lot of challenges in this evolution, but I think it's going to happen whether we do it well or not. The
Agreed.
thing is, we have the fertility crisis all over the world, as you know. The birth rate is falling. They think that the birth rate and fertility may have already peaked, and we may be now in the downturn because very few countries, as you know, are replacing themselves. And so that's going to continue. Not only that, we have a health crisis, as you know, Adam, where people are, well, in the United States, people are now dying. The longevity is no longer going up, it's going down. And that's to a large degree because of all these horrendous food systems that have been given to people, the ability to not move, and now all the drug and pharmaceutical intervention, all that. So we've got a lot of ways that we could improve the human experience, the human health, quality of life. But we have to get away from, for example, thinking that everyone's a profit center for things like energy. Because if you look at the amount of AI demand for power that's happening right now, all these TikTok videos and all this stuff that we're constantly watching, it doesn't come for free, right? It costs a lot in terms of energy. And those CPUs have to be kept cool. So we have a huge explosion right now in demand for technology solutions. Now, the good news is technology has always been evolving to solve our inflationary restrictions. And yes, we have to do a lot of short-term investment, but people always discount the S-curve, the thing that you were speaking of how quickly these things transition and the adoption rate. So I think that is definitely the future. And we have to really look at the cost savings. So if we can't grow revenue easily in this environment, maybe what we have to look at is how do we get food, healthy food, health in humans, energy in a full cost accounting way that is a fraction of the current cost. And that means looking at all the harm that we're currently creating and figuring out solutions that don't create all that harm. So there is a lot of opportunity here to do things smarter and more productive, more efficient, and lower cost that way. But at some point, you're right, we have a question mark about how we're going to replace income and activity and occupation. How will we keep people happy and engaged and productive if we're taking all of our day jobs away, right? So this is, and I don't pretend to know how this is all going to go, but I know it's happening. And it's likely to happen much faster than people believe right now. That's typical. I think over the next decade, it's going to blow our hair back how quick this transition is happening. And so just understanding that, and then, you know, as the rethinks people warn, the urge to prop up the status quo. So the good news is all this is here and possible to have a brighter future, but there is no foregone conclusion as to whether that'll be the case. That very much depends upon how open-minded we are and how intelligent we are with our capital allocation decisions.
Yeah, well, so I think it's our job as individuals to try to, you know, look where the puck is headed, like you're talking about, and agitate for the right solutions, but try to position ourselves to adopt the right solutions and not count on the status quo evolving on the timeline we'd like it to, because, as you know, you've said, the status quo has so many power players that benefit from it that they are going to fight the change until the their last dying breath, basically.
And so, boomers all right. are terrible. I got to tell you, Adam, like, you're younger than me, I think, so we're not quite boomers.
I don't know about that.
But the boomers are terrible. I got to say, I mean, all my friends are boomers. Most of them are completely oblivious about all these trends, and they're adamant that the old ways can continue. And I think that's just really like dumb. It's just not very insightful. And I don't think it's going to help. I think we need to get very proactive and open-minded. And this is, like you say, this will burst apart either in a very, you know, destructive, negative way, or in a opening up of abundance and opportunity way. And I'd like to go that way myself.
I would too. I kind of think it's going to do both. I think it's going to do the bursting apart in a painful way, and then we'll finally find ourselves to the abundance way. So I'm sort of a long-term optimist, but a near-term pessimist, or I like to think just sort of a realist. I think that's generally how humans work. All right, look, I still want to get to your market outlook, but before we get there, to your point about this thing, change coming faster than most people can imagine right now and getting really caught by surprise by it. And I think all of us, like, I think nations are going to be caught by surprise by a lot of this too, and they're going to be figuring out solutions in real time. So I worry about the social ramifications of this, of people getting so badly surprised, in many cases, people being very unprepared for this, like you were saying earlier. And I want to just get your thoughts here, because you're based in Canada. And like I mentioned earlier, I think Canada oftentimes, or in many ways, is a preview of coming attractions to the US. So you guys have had declining GDP per capita for six consecutive quarters. That is a big deal. And then tied to that is this secret Royal Canadian Mounted Police report that came out. You might have heard about it. It basically warning that Canadians may revolt once they realize how broke they are. So, I mean, the government itself is being like, look, we're sort of sitting on the social time bomb here. How concerned are you that social time bomb is indeed going to go off in this unwinding?
Well, I see evidence of it all around me, actually. I was speaking to realtors just yesterday who I hadn't checked in with for a while, and they were saying, a year ago, they were saying, "Oh no, Danielle, people are still buying. Young people are still getting money from their parents, and they're still wanting in the property ladder and all that." And now that I'm speaking to them, they're saying, "Oh yeah, no, it's really slow. Like people are, the sellers are still wanting, again, boomers own most of the property, not to pick on boomers, sorry guys, but you own most of the property. You're looking to cash out money for retirement, downsize expenses because you would like more cash to spend in your later years. And you're hoping that someone's going to come along and buy these assets off you, whether it's securities, in the public markets, or whether it's private funds or mix, all these things that savings has flowed into over the past few years, and real estate. And yes, there may be people who want to buy those assets, but you have to look at the availability of their income to service and purchase that those things. And there's a huge disconnect right now. So I do think there's a standoff continuing between those who are hoping that prices will be back to where they were during the pandemic when money was free, and the reality of a lot of other people who are just, it's, there's no chance they're going to be able to buy those things. So I think that social trend is going to continue. One of the ironic factors, you mentioned the Canadian GDP per capita and how negative it's been. One of the reasons for that is not just that our productivity has been weak and we put all our money into housing like fools instead of into productive technology and innovation. We haven't tried to direct our policies, our tax policies, everything has been about speculation in real estate, and that's really cost us and set us behind. But the other thing has been a huge amount of immigration, and this is partly the government trying to be a proactive in looking at the really dismal fertility rates and birth rates in the country and saying, wow, we need young bodies somehow to come in and help us pull these old folks forward. And so they have on the in the short term added something like 4 million Canadians in the past few years, which has made our, in the short run, it's a big cost. It's hard to absorb that many people that fast. You have waiting lines for our medical services, and it's put a lot of stress on rents, and it's difficult to get housing for all those people. And a lot of them came here for false pretenses because they were sold a bunch of malarkey about education. A lot of them were young people were attracted here for the idea that they would just do this course at a mall, a strip mall, and they would all of a sudden have a great high-paying job. There's been a lot of fraud and predatory behavior of young people in the space from a lot of developing countries. So that's all on us. Like that, we shouldn't have allowed that. Now it's costing us a lot. So in the one hand, I understand the impulse to bring in the new people, but I don't think that the government has taken into account, as other governments haven't either, as I say, this quick change that's happening with humanoid robotics and the AI space, which may indeed make many of those people not as essential or needed as workers as we thought. And so the question becomes, to what extent can we get people productive in the sense of producing income for their efforts, right? It's not just activity, it has to produce income, revenue. That's the thing that is in great deficit right now. And so if we can't grow the top line, like I said, we got to focus on how to reduce the costs within the system so that people have more net income available.
All right. God, I get several questions I'd like to ask more. Let me just limit it to this one, which is, do you expect part of the social backlash to be reflected in the next election there? I know you're not a political analyst, but you are Canadian. Do you think that Trudeau is going to be replaced? Looking at the latest polls, he's not. It's not looking good. And if so, will his successor, what kind of mandate do you think they'll have from the populace?
So unfortunately, I think we have a very similar system to what you guys have, and you've got these two candidates, neither of which are very appealing, right? Neither party leader right now is someone that I think is going to really be embraced by the public in this really challenging period where we need to think outside the box and have lots of innovation. We've got the Liberal government, yes, and they're very low in the polls right now, and everyone's upset with the lack of productivity and the negative GDP and the housing bubble coming down. Again, a couple of years ago, when housing was going up and people thought they were getting wealthy just sitting there, they were a lot happier with the government policies. But now that they see that the bubble's bursting and they can't sell their properties for what they bought them for a couple of years ago. Now everyone's quite upset, right? And so there's general backlash and unhappiness in the populace. Plus we've had them in a, you know, government, there's an appetite for a couple of terms and then that's max, they want change. Unfortunately, the change I see offered on the conservative side right now is like a, almost like a Trump style mindlessness, not very proactive, not expressing the kind of insight we need in terms of this technological transition we need to make, thinking about the status quo, how do we bootstrap the old, you know, the old economy, all that. So I think we've got horrible choices. And I believe that it's the same reason that you do in America, which is corporations have purchased the political system and corporations, the largest ones with the most money, are holding the status quo. So we only get these puppet kind of options on both sides, and we call it diversity of opportunity. Really, it's the same thing. It's a corporatocracy and they're controlling the policies, and we have to have people sort of really put their foot down, rise up, somehow fight back against this machine. And as you say, that tends to be very messy historically. So I'm not really optimistic that either option. I think we probably will get a change of government, but I don't think that the incoming offering is going to take us in the right direction either. They tend to be talking about really old school policies. So, you know, I'm not real optimistic on the political opportunity there, but we need someone that can speak with financial literacy and truth. We have to have someone who's got all that within the scope and can talk to the population and explain why we need to do these painful things, because it is painful in the short run.
All right. Okay. I'm trying to wrest myself away from these other questions just in the interest of time. All right. So your market outlook, given everything that we've talked about, I've got to assume that your market outlook isn't super sanguine from here. I mean, maybe the system gets propped up for a bit longer. Maybe it reaches a crescendo or things go even higher from here for a while. I don't get the sense you think they're going to just continue going to higher and higher levels without some sort of substantial price correction, but don't let me put words in your mouth. What is your outlook right now for the markets for the rest of this year?
Yeah, so into the fall last year, it was making some sense, right? We had the interest rates going up. We had risk assets reflecting that selling off. Then we had the big rebound in the past 6 months, 7 months, where a lot of that, I think, was a reignition of this misplaced belief that rate cutting was going to be the panacea and was going to solve all the problems in the economy and bail out all the financial speculation. So you kind of had a self-fulfilling prophecy there where the financial markets rallied and that eased financial conditions, but they haven't been able to cut at the extent that was previously hoped or priced in. So you've got that impasse now where the reality is, oh, rates are staying higher for longer. The bond market certainly sold off in reflection of that, but the stock market, you know, is like the idiot cousin in some ways. It just ignores the math and hopes for the best. So where we are right now is you've got corporate debt, junk debt, all at extreme high valuations. It's outperformed government debt by the most ever in history the past 2 years. So when you look at the credit quality issue and into the environment that I'm describing, which is, you know, whether we continue to get huge fiscal largesse through the back door in the US into the election, maybe we will, but the first year of the presidential term, you know, in 2025 is not likely to continue that. They tend to be a hard year, the first year of a presidential election, because it's mm-hmm. the paying, not the promising part, right? So whether we have to wait a few more months for some of this federal money to dissipate out of the US economy, and then the impacts that's sort of driving things in terms of holding up some demand, but I think that we're getting to the very end of how long that can continue. And then we've got these interest rates, as I say, still, you know, normal by long-term. I'm not saying they're extreme historically, they're normal, but the debt service costs are extreme. And so I don't think we've fixed anything. I think that we're going to continue to see downward pressure on the risk side. We need to, that's a good thing, but it's going to be painful for those people that are holding that. So at this point, I like the least risk options in terms of, you know, the T-bills at 5%, the government debt, which, as I say, is presently priced to yield more than 4 with very low principal risk. And you can buy those things at a discount, so you get some capital gain on top of the coupon. So, you know, all that is pretty attractive in this environment. But the equity side, I'm still pretty uninterested.
Okay. And I just want to note one thing you said here in a recent report of yours, that wealth destruction is set to be higher this cycle because households hold a record 48% of their financial assets in equities, a level matched only at the 2000 cycle peak. So basically, your earlier comment about people oftentimes having the exact wrong allocation right when the reckoning hits, you feel like we're particularly vulnerable this time around.
Yeah, because people are older. I like to point this out, but it seems obvious but not noticed, is that everyone's 23 years older, 24 years older than we were at the tech top in 2000, right? And we had a big debacle that blew up, and you know, the tech stuff that could do no wrong fell 80%, and it took 15 years to recover. And even with the normal, you know, more generic S&P 500, the TSX, the broad-based indexes, which most people have the most exposure to in their portfolios, fell by more than 48% and took, you know, 5 or 6 years just to get back to square. And so when I look at, for example, the TSX is an example of that, where we had, you know, we peaked in 2008 with the commodities mania that was going on with the China story at that time. And the Canadian dollar was very strong, and, you know, everybody wanted our rocks and trees. And you had a kind of a big overvaluation in the Canadian stock market along with the US market. And then we went along for the plunge, even though our recession wasn't as deep as yours, and we were in relatively better shape going into that, our stock market still lost about half and took years to recover. And the irony is that, you know, for all the talk about people reporting, oh, it's up X this year, up Y, whatever, once you lose a lot and spend years just trying to get back to square, that's where there's no compound gains there. There's no, you know, everyone talks about the returns of the stock market. What they miss is that you can't lose principal and spend years just trying to get back to square. You have to actually have income reinvested. And most people are taking out money. You know, you get into the boomers, they're now in net withdrawers in the financial economy. They, because of their age bracket, you know, they're now taking out more than they're putting in. So that's one factor. And then you have that also a lot of them are paying quite significant fees for their financial management. And once you take out fees and withdrawals, you're sucking out the dividend and not having reinvestment. So you're really stuck with hoping that you get a capital gain performance in terms of trying to grow your money over the long run. And that's the piece where if you're buying at high valuations, like the Canadian stock market basically did this into 2021. It wasn't until it really started to break out after the pandemic that we got any positive gains at all. And if you look at the long-term return in terms of capital gains since 2008, it's just been around 3% a year for the Canadian market. And that's because it got so overvalued, and it's overvalued again, right? So it looks, you can look like you're getting somewhere, but when the big sell-offs come, they typically take you back. 14 years of gains is wiped out in one bear market. And then you realize that it was all smoke and mirrors, and you didn't actually get anywhere in terms of net benefit, net worth, you know, cash out of the fire and into the pan sort of thing. So that's why, you know, it's hard for people, I understand, but you have to be very aware of the risk. And when it's priced really high, like it is today, the risk is very high as well.
Hugely important reminder, and we do have a lot of the average age on this, or 2/3 of the watchers of this video, these videos are 45 years and older. So we have a lot of people in that cohort that really need to be very risk focused. All right, Danielle, it has just been wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on, especially given your busy schedule. Please know that anytime that you want to come back on here and kind of, you know, give an update on your outlook based upon how things are changing, you've got an open invitation to. I know the audience would love for you to do that. Very quickly, for folks that have really enjoyed this and would like to follow you and your work between now and the next time you come back on, where should they go?
So I'm on Twitter. You can follow me there. My daily blog is jugglingdynamite.com, where I write pretty much every day. And then also our firm website is venablepark.com.
Fantastic. When I edit this, Danielle, I will put up the links to those right on the screen so folks know where to go. Folks, we'll have the links in the description below the video as well. Been a total pleasure, Danielle. Look forward to having you back on soon.
Thanks so much, Adam.
All right. Well, now's the time of the program. We bring in one of the endorse financial advisors by Thoughtful Money to react to what Danielle just told us, and also to give any commentary that they think is relevant, given what's happened in the markets over the past week. I'm usually joined at this time by the guys from New Harbor Financial, but since Danielle is based in Canada, and we talked a bit about Canada in the interview, we're joined today by Jonathan Wellum, who is the CEO and founder of RockLink Investment Partners and their Thoughtful Money's endorsed advisor in Canada. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Adam. Good to be with you again.
Good to be with you too. Well, look, a lot of information packed into that hour discussion with Danielle. Curious to hear what some of your key takeaways were.
Yes, I really enjoyed the interview. I wasn't overly familiar with Danielle, but I'm definitely going to be tracking her and following her going forward. And she's just up the road from me. I think she's just up in Barrie, Ontario, which is probably only about an hour's drive. Close proximity. I enjoyed in particular. I mean, a couple of things that I would identify. Number one, just caution and making sure that people are walking into the market with their eyes wide open and not just following the consensus kind of thinking. There are an awful lot of risks out in the marketplace as you discuss on a regular basis, and people shouldn't be naive to those just because the market has been rather robust in terms of the equity prices. One has to look underneath the hood and be concerned with the debt levels, some slowing in the economy. We're seeing some of those cracks in the economy, whether it's in the housing market, whether it's in consumer spending now, as we're seeing some of the companies, especially some of the restaurants and retailers are a little bit softer. I mean, people are still spending, but they're going to have to allocate a lot more into food and prices for their mortgages and insurance and things like that. So there's just a lot more stresses coming into the system. So I think she really emphasized, be on top of the game. Don't be naive. Make sure you're buying companies that, investing in areas with proper valuations. Things are not cheap. If you do buy into a market at the top, you might be many years before you get your return back. She emphasized on the TSX, the Toronto stock market, and she's quite right. It reached a high back in 2008. In the summer of 2008, with the commodities, oil was about $120. And of course, it was going to go to 300 at the time. And that was propelling the market. And then it took another 10 years or longer to get a return on the TSX again after it crashed, to get back up to its highs again. So all of that, I think, was really well articulated by Danielle. Just those caution, know where you're investing, be careful. Fixed income, if you're going to, get 4 or 5%, is not a bad place to have some of your money while we're watching this unfold. There's a lot of other smart people that share that opinion. Probably the biggest one would be Warren Buffett, who's sitting on a little extra cash now. And so I think that caution. She also talked a little bit about what you mentioned, and we certainly agree with that lag effect. We are starting to see that lag effect come in. In Canada, that's resulted in a much softer housing market. We're seeing a little bit of that in the U.S. also now. And even in the recent numbers, the CPI numbers that just were out this morning, we're seeing again, maybe inflation actually is moderating. And again, some softness there in some of the segments of that. So those are, I think, excellent, excellent points that she drew our attention to in the discussion that she had.
Great. First off, I always enjoy talking to you folks in Canada for the reason that I say. I think you guys are giving us a sense of where the puck is headed, elsewhere in the West. And certainly in the housing market, you guys are ahead of us because you guys have much shorter duration mortgages. I think the average mortgage duration for you guys fixed at least is 5 years. So essentially, 20% of your mortgages come available for re-rate every year. In fact, it's more than that because I think there's also just variable mortgages there too. You're nodding as I'm saying all this. So sadly, you guys are taking it in the shorts faster than we are as folks' mortgages have to take out new, much more expensive mortgages. One of the things that Danielle said, and I'd love to get your thoughts on it, Jonathan, as a capital manager, is she was looking at people's positioning right now, and it's about as all in on equities for the baby boomer generation, as we've seen in the data. I think it was you know, back up right before the last bubble burst. And again, her big point, which I believe you share, is, you know, if you sort of sleepwalk into a stock market correction, it can set you back, like you said, you know, in some cases a decade, you know, at times. And a lot of people of that older generation, they don't have the runway to be able to try to, you know, get back to even over a 10-year period. So risk management, you know, is incredibly important for that cohort in general. But certainly given today's valuations, it seems like something that they should really be leaning into. As a capital manager, how are you dealing with risk management given the high valuations we're seeing in the markets right now?
Yeah, and excellent points. And we see this in a number of our clients. So without getting into specific details, I mean, we do have clients that are fairly close to the wire. I mean, they're older, they're retired, they have a certain amount of money, but they need almost every dollar to make it with, you know, to the end of their expected life type of thing. And again, to pay bills that can get more intense and grow, especially in the last year or two of life if you need extra care. And so we are very concerned that they don't have capital losses. And so what does that mean? It means that we have to talk to them and say, look, we're going to go for lower returns in this particular market by keeping a little bit more cash around, buying more fixed income type investments. It's not the ideal situation. Everyone wants to, you know, be in all the equities, but we're just cautioning them that you cannot afford to take a drawdown. You do not have the time to make it back. And the other problem that comes in is, as you know, also, Adam, when you're dealing with clients, if they do take a drawdown, emotionally, they can become incredibly unstable. Mm-hmm. And be very, very nervous about the future, and then make even more rash decisions in the wrong direction. So so we have to just smooth things out, talk to them very carefully, build models for them. So we say, listen, even if you're going to get maybe a little bit lower return now, but we're not going to take a drawdown, you're going to go along just nicely. This is a better way to protect your capital. So yeah, it's really having heart-to-heart discussions with the clients. I mean, we care about these people, it's very important that they don't get into a bad situation. One of the things that Danielle also mentioned was dividend paying stocks. And I thought that was also a very helpful part of the conversation, that, you know, dividend paying stocks also can go down. Mm-hmm. And they are generally more conservative. If you have the time to weather things, absolutely. Collecting that dividend is helpful, but it's not, you know, your total redemption or salvation type of thing. You do have to also be careful. And we love some dividend paying stocks also, but we also like to buy them on the cheap. And so again, if there is more volatility, and you've got some cash, you can also dip into some of these great companies that can come off, you know, 15, 20, 30%. And we can't be surprised by that when we're talking to clients and doing financial planning for them in the future.
All right. I'm presuming that if we get the type of market correction that I think you believe we're due, you are somewhat excited about the opportunity to buy some great companies at much better valuations today. You're nodding as I'm saying this. I'd love to get your quick thoughts on your reaction to this week's action in the meme stocks, most notably GameStop. You know, we're talking about the rich valuations in the markets today. Something like what just happened with GameStop has got to make you think, like, wait a minute, this is, you know, this is getting back into crazy town again.
Yeah, for a value investor and someone who wants to be in investments and compound on a tax-deferred basis for reasonable periods of time, the game stocks, these meme stocks, which is a GameStop, it's just total insanity. I mean, it's total insanity. Now, if people want to play in that space, then that's obviously their business and they have the freedom to do it. But that is pure speculation, and it's very close to gambling. And we have no interest in that at all. And we want to be, you know, business people buying businesses and compounding. That's the more predictable way to create wealth for the long term and more wealth, because, you know, as we like to point out, if you look at the Fortune 500 list of billionaires, there's no stock market, you know, speculators on there. These are all business people. And then even on the investment side, the ones that are the wealthiest actually created their wealth by having a business in the financial service industry. And they're all long-term investors in a handful of stocks. And so, you know, this get rich quick scheme by gambling is a quick way to really lose a lot of money. And we just caution people, please, please, please don't get swept up in that. It's very dangerous. And if you are going to get involved in that, which we say don't, but if you are, then you'd want to be using very calculated percentages of your money so that if you lost it all, it wouldn't matter. But our advice is stay clear of it.
Okay. Can you talk for just a moment about your approach there at Rocklink? Because my understanding is other firms will oftentimes use sort of a sector approach and buy general ETFs and kind of create a portfolio of sectors. I'm curious to what extent you do that, if at all, but I know that kind of your bread and butter there at Rocklink is really looking for great companies, doing the old school, due diligence of, financial and strategic analysis of individual companies, trying to find the gems in there. And then, it's almost like a Buffett approach, building a portfolio of great companies that you know very well and track very closely. You're nodding as I'm saying this. So can you just elaborate for folks on how you specifically take your investing approach there?
Yeah, I mean, when I got in the business in 1990, I was schooled really by Buffett in terms of I read everything that Buffett had published. The individual that got me into the investment business, Michael Lee Chin, who's a very successful investor, he said, Jonathan, one of the things that happens in our industry is that people just trade stocks and they just treat them like little pieces of paper and not ownership stakes in businesses. So wealth really is created by compounding your ownership for long periods of times in great companies at reasonable prices. So we studied and went down. I think I've been to 15 or 16 annual meetings in Omaha, Nebraska. Haven't been to the ones recently, but and it was quite the Woodstock of capitalism, they used to call it, and they probably still call it that, and it's true. But our view was, and even more so as the markets have become much more ETF focused and index focused, everybody's just buying the same baskets or the same exposure. Our view was go the opposite direction. Find 20 to 25 really good companies, research them in detail, understand the companies, talk to management, run your finance, your models on them and so forth. Try to buy them at, discounts to, their free cash flow values, your present value of the future cash flow streams and so forth, or net asset value, depending on the business. And just own a handful so that it's hard to follow 100 businesses, 200 businesses, 1,000 companies, but you can follow 20, 25 and get to know them. And so that's what we do. We create portfolios for clients where seldom would there be more than 25 stocks in the portfolio, but they're great companies. And we do try to cut across a few different sectors so that we don't become too concentrated in one sector. You do have to spread yourself around a little bit because anything can happen in one sector that might inordinately hurt your portfolio, something like that. So, for example, we'll look at the whole area of EVs and the utilities having the electric utilities being under capacity and having to rebuild their systems and so forth. And you look at a company like Schneider Electric, which is a leader in creating the components and the equipment and the material for utilities that have to spend the money on the infrastructure. They're also building data centers. And so look at a company like that and say, okay, there's a long-term secular opportunity for a business like that. If we can buy them at a reasonable price, then that's a business we want to own for the next few years because you've got these great secular trends buttressing them. And even if the economy goes into a bit of a recession, those are still areas that continue to grow at a faster rate, things like that. So we own a big company, Brookfield Renewable, and they have tremendous production of renewable energy. Well, they just signed their stock was kind of meandering for a while, but we love the business continuing to grow. They just signed the largest contract of its kind with Microsoft, and Microsoft and these big tech companies want to use green energy for all of their AI development. And so they signed these long-term contracts with Brookfield Renewable, which will provide the green energy production for them kind of thing. So we're always looking for stories and opportunities under the surface and businesses that can buck the trend over the next number of years and grow and do it and do it with high quality. I mean, high quality earnings, high quality presence in the economy and at reasonable prices. So that's the way we go about it. And I think the more people buy indexes, we just say, hey, we want to go get as far away from that as possible. That's a strategy. We're not putting that down, but we want to differentiate and add more value.
Well, that's a very old school and time-honored approach. Yeah, I've had a lot of guests on the program, Mike Green being probably at the forefront, who's been warning about this whole, you know, passive monstrosity that the market's become, where every new dollar that comes in, a good chunk of that's going into the same few companies simply because they're so overowned across all these ETFs. So just the math pushes it all out there. Which is great if you own those companies while cash flows or capital flows are positive. But if we ever get to a point where capital flows are negative, you may find your ETF going down for reasons you can't understand, but it's simply because it actually just happens to own high concentration of these few stocks, which most other ETFs own as well. Your approach will be very insulated from that. It'll be much more specific to how your own custom portfolio is faring. All right. As we wrap up here, I'm just curious, Jonathan, are there any particular trades or decisions you're making in your portfolio right now, given the current market environment? Or are there things that you're keeping a close eye on that if you see, you're going to make a portfolio change?
Yeah, I don't think so. We're pretty comfortable with sort of the decisions we've been making the last little while. I mean, we also have probably a much larger weighting in precious metals exposure than many of our competitors or other money managers, or certainly the indexes would. That's an area, again, where they become very underweighted in the indexes. And we think that, exposure to gold, silver, even copper, which is very important if we're going to electrify, nickel, potash, things like that are very important commodities that are critical in going forward. So we try to, again, get some exposure to those areas, and they tend to be a little more defensive. Things get messy. I mean, yeah, everything will go down. If everything, if you're in a big market sell-off, then almost every asset goes down in the short run. But I think, again, the gold, the silver exposure also will at least help mitigate some of that. And we see some good opportunities there because we are watching the currencies. And as we've talked before, and as you talked with many of your guests, I mean, at some point, this debt buildup, there has to be payday. And so we just want to have some insurance and some protection in our portfolios. Also, again, you're not going to get that in the indexes. I mean, the indexes have virtually no exposure to some of these precious metals and some of these important areas that will, we think, become potentially more important going forward to collateralize our currencies, especially in an uncertain environment where people don't trust each other going forward. So we'll see.
Okay. So don't want to put words in your mouth, but those metals, both the precious metals and copper, have actually done pretty well of late. Is it fair to say that you think to a certain extent, it's just getting started given the longer term secular opportunity you see?
I think that that's certainly potentially the case, we think that the prices can go higher. We're not calling ridiculously high prices. I mean, which could materialize if there's a crisis. But we're also looking at the individual securities and some of the miners. We don't own a lot of the miners. We have some, but also the royalty companies. They've gone up, but they're still producing a massive amount of cash flow. And I would suggest that some of them are far from being overvalued. Even if the price just stayed where it was, it is now. These are producing tremendous free cash flow yields. And so some of these companies, again, are dividends are going up. They're going to be buying back more stock. And so I think there's some good value opportunities in that space also I think will continue to provide good growth, even without massive increase or a significant increase in the actual price of the precious metals themselves going forward.
All right. Okay. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Folks, if you've enjoyed this this interview with Danielle and with Jonathan, and would like to see both of them come back on the program soon, please let us know by hitting the like button and clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. As Danielle said, very uncertain time, lots of further uncertainty ahead. She's quite worried about how this is all going to end up. thinks a lot of people are going to potentially sleepwalk into the next market correction. Highly recommend that most of the people watching this video right now navigate what's coming under the guidance of a good financial advisor who takes into account all the issues that Danielle and I talked about. And when we put that those two requirements together, good financial advisor and one that takes into account all these macro requirements, the universe of potential advisors gets really pretty small. But if you've got a good one who's doing that for you, great, stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion from one who does, maybe even Jonathan and his team there at RockLink, then consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the advisors that Thoughtful Money endorses. To do that, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com, fill out the short form there, only takes you a couple of seconds. But as I've said frequently recently, only do it if you are ready to have these discussions and to take action, whether you're going to take action on your own, whether you're going to take action with your existing advisor, or potentially keep talking to these guys. We're kind of becoming victims of our own success here in sending a lot of leads to these advisors, which is great. And they definitely want to talk to you. But I just want to make sure that you guys are invested and prepared so that everybody is getting the most out of these conversations. So, Jonathan, with that, thank you for coming on and giving us your both your Canadian perspective, but also just your insights, wisdom, and the expertise of your approach, which I think is appealing to a lot of folks that watch these videos. As we wrap up here, I'd just like to give you an opportunity to give any closing words you'd like to give to today's investors watching this channel. What would be your general counsel to them?
Yeah, just be careful, have good, proper expectations. Don't be naive to the challenges that exist in the marketplace. And but still, I mean, just look for opportunities. Look for opportunities. There's always opportunities in the market. And that's what we have to really zero in on. I'd also say, if you're speaking to my Canadian compatriots here, we have an election coming up in the next year, and let's make a change. I think we can make a change in this country, and put into political leadership individuals who will be much more friendly to capital markets and investing, and get more money back into Canada. It's a great country to invest in if we have the proper rules, regulations, and leadership in the country. So I'm a bit more optimistic than I think Danielle, when she was commenting on in terms of some of the political situation. I think people are waking up to some of the challenges, and hopefully that also will lead to better decisions all around in businesses and in governments.
All right. Well, great point, which is, if you if you're tired of not seeing the type of change you want to see, we as the electorate have a responsibility to get out there and advocate for the reform that we want. So, great point. All right. Well, Jonathan, look, thanks so much. Look forward to seeing you back on the program soon. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.